It's officially DC festival season, and we're super excited about this one coming up on May 18th. Africa on the Avenue is a celebration of the vibrant African immigrant community along Georgia Avenue Northwest. There's going to be interactive art installations, fashion shows, music, food, and local business stands. This one-day festival, organized by District Bridges' Lower Georgia Avenue Main Street program, truly has something for everyone. So I'll see you there on May 18th. Go to districtbridges.org to learn more.
Today on CityCast DC, we are talking city budget with City Paper's Alex Coma. And Washingtonian's Jessica Sidman is here to talk about DC winners of the James Beard Awards and to tell us a crazy spy story that seemed to have really happened at a Russian restaurant here. Today is Friday, April 5th. I'm Michael Schaefer, and here's what DC is talking about. Hey, Jess.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Awesome to see you. Hey, Alex.
Hello. Great to be back.
Good to see you, too. Alex writes the Loose Lips column in City Paper, where all three of us have at different points in our life worked. And you have been all over the city budget, which was rolled out this week. It's often a kind of boring broccoli news cycle where, you know, you'll get these like press releases from like really narrow interest groups who are either like pleased or upset about things. This year, though, after a lot of years of good budget stuff in DC, we've sort of entered an austerity budget cycle, and it's pretty grim, and it's sort of a question of whose ox is getting gored. And it's just the mayor's proposal. Like, they're gonna have to vote on it. It's like a, you know, a first bid in a negotiation. But Alex, what do you make of what she rolled out and where it's likely to head?
Yeah, it has been a chaotic year, inspired by exactly the dynamic that you're discussing. Even though it was a pandemic, there were some pretty good budgets for the last few years, mostly because of a lot of federal aid that was sort of, you know, lessening the blow of the disruptions of COVID. But a lot of that's drying up. A lot of the factors that, you know, we've been watching in the economy about the, you know, persistence of remote work and the, you know, accompanying fall in commercial property values. I mean, they're starting to squeeze DC. There is no doubt about it. The city is not growing the way that it used to. And that is now forcing a lot of difficult choices. As you say, that could be a very boring story. But this year has at least had a lot of excitement in the fact that no one in city government can agree on how to handle this problem. They're all fighting with each other. They all seem to quite dislike each other, which is not necessarily anything new for DC. But it has meant that you have the mayor and the council chair siding with each other against the independent chief financial officer, sending sternly worded memos back and forth. It led to a point where this budget is actually coming out about 2 or 3 weeks later than it was supposed to because of all this bickering, because of all these threats. And the number one takeaway that I've had after, you know, a few weeks of reporting on all the goings on in the Wilson building is that relationships have sort of frayed, you know, to the barest of bare ends here. And it's going to make the next, I think, 70 days they have now to hash out what's in the rest of this budget rather unpleasant.
All right, let's cut to the chase. She got $500 million or so hole she needs to fill. And that means she wants to find some new ways to get new money. But probably the headline items are things she wants to do away with, like the circulator bus. Tell me what is on the chopping block as far as the mayor goes.
Yeah, she has proposed, you know, a lot of cuts to balance this budget. You mentioned the circulator, which you'll recall, I mean, years ago was one of the premier programs pushed by the Bowser administration. So it is kind of funny to see her doing away with it entirely. But her rationale is we're giving more money to Metro, so the circulator has got to go. It's redundant compared to some Metro bus lines. So that's on the chopping block.
They also say it didn't bounce back from pandemic the way the rest of the bus system and Metro did.
Yeah, absolutely. Which makes sense. I mean, it serves a lot of downtown. That sort of stands to reason. But the people in my mentions after I tweeted about the circular being gone surely would tell you otherwise. That is definitely the one that caught me by the most surprise. The one that I have been hearing the most rumors about in terms of cuts was the Early Child Educator Fund. This was money, it's about $70 million a year for the next 4 years, that was meant to provide raises for people working in childcare facilities, daycares, anyone, you know, taking care of kids sort of before they make it into the school system. And, you know, this has been an initiative of the council for several years now, the idea being that these people are paid less than public school or public charter teachers, even though they're doing equally valuable work, you know, helping people go to work if they've got kids. And so this has been years in the making to try and bring these educators sort of back to pay parity. It is essentially giving money to the facilities they work for, in many cases, incentivizing them to go out and get better, you know, degrees, master's degrees to do this work.
Okay, so in real life, this is going to mean daycare prices go up. Which will mean some people can't afford them.
Very likely. Or even worse, make it less available. A lot of these facilities fear that their staff will see this uncertainty in their pay. Many of them, you know, may have to go back down to minimum wage or the equivalent of it. And they would say, well, forget this. Why am I still doing this job?
There's also, you know, in D.C., the conversation is never very far, even in a bad economic moment. The conversation is never very far from, like, can I afford to actually live here? And the city's spent a bunch of money over the years on trying to create more affordable housing and otherwise help people pay rent in the housing that does exist now. And some of that stuff is also facing the chop.
Yeah, another area, much like the circulator, that was Bowser's signature over her second term in particular was affordable housing. You know, she has, for I think every year of her administration over her last 9-10 years doing DC budgets, has put $100 million into the city's main affordable housing loan fund. She didn't do that this year. She, you know, called this out and said, look, I'm asking the council to cut some of their priorities. I'm cutting one of my main priorities. She's only putting $60 million into that fund this year. There are also pretty big cuts to emergency rental assistance. This is a fight that the council and the mayor have every year, and they are certainly going to have it this year. The mayor is cutting money from that fund, reasoning that people are going back to work. She went on a long rant at the council about how people are taking advantage of the emergency rental fund. This is not supported by any evidence, but it is an argument that she likes to make. And so you are going to see a lot of fights between the mayor and the council on this subject in particular.
So just to be clear, there's also some places where she wants to spend a bunch of money. I mean, they just agreed to $500 million to basically renovate the arena and keep this thing that's been cast as like a business anchor and cultural anchor for downtown. They have a downtown plan that they intend to fund and some school stuff and some public safety stuff. So, you know, I mean, Jess, you cover restaurant industry, and these are folks who are very sensitive both to like actual crime, but also to the perception of like the city is like turning out the lights. I assume this kind of spending is designed both to like do actual things, but also to mollify that kind of fear.
Right. Yeah. I think one of the big talking points for restaurant owners in the city, specifically the Restaurant Association, has been, you know, how can we address crime, let people know it is safe to eat out in DC? You know, it is, but like, obviously there are these incidents that are very high profile. I can't say, you know, whether they support these specific funding measures or not, but I know that certainly crime is a hot issue for the industry right now.
Alex, is there a pattern to the places where the administration wants to spend more money?
Yeah, you know, I think that you identified a lot of it. And this has begun to rub some people the wrong way because the mayor has described this as we're sharing in the cuts, you know, but we're also, you know, sort of sharing in the benefits. But, you know, some of the council and advocates are saying, no, a lot of this money is designed to revive downtown. And that is, of course, a goal that the mayor has been pursuing that many on the council agree with. That's where a lot of the city's tax base comes from. As you note, you know, they put a lot of effort into, you know, retaining the Wizards and Capitals to keep downtown thriving. But, you know, even some council members were grumbling yesterday that, you know, the mayor is, at the request of many downtown business leaders, sort of doubling down on efforts to convert office buildings into residential, to make new green spaces and then activate them, to have more grant programs and marketing campaigns to get people downtown. And they're saying, hold on, this is great. You know, we know we need this. But on the other hand, they're asking for a big payroll tax increase on businesses, big and small. This will affect both the big guys downtown and the smaller restaurants in the hospitality industry. And so they're saying, you know, we're glad that this might redound to downtown's benefit, but they're also asking for, you know, a lot of sacrifice from some of the same people they're trying to help. It's sort of a muddled picture that I'm not sure we've figured out quite yet.
Yeah, man, I saw some of that stuff, and it was, you know, there was a sort of, you know, why are you funding downtown when, you know, a lot of neighborhoods need help too? And to me, at least, it seemed to be kind of an apples and oranges thing, because like, you know, it seems to me that like in the economy and the health of DC, downtown is more like a factory that produces this product, which is, you know, office rentals and paper and people walking around and spending money. And if the factory's in trouble, that sort of hurts the broader economy. It's different than like just a neighborhood where you want to have like a safe and vibrant commercial area and, you know, clean streets and stuff.
I think that's absolutely true. But I also think that, you know, it's a question at a certain point of optics, because on the one hand, it deserves to be said, the $500 million for Capital One, that's coming from the capital budget. It's not where money for social programs comes for. So you can't just say, look, the mayor's spending all this in downtown and not on poor people. Those are, you know, as you say, apples and oranges. But it remains to be said that, you know, she's making all of these cuts, often to priorities, let's say it, that were advanced by the council because they're not her babies. So it's easier for her to slash them. And so when seeing cut after cut after cut to a program in Ward 4, a program in Ward 1, it's starting to feel for them a little personal. Like they're like, okay, you know, we're all being asked to make sacrifices, but you are tripling down on downtown programs, cutting the things that are important to us and my constituents. That's going to create some tension, whether or not that, you know, it's a viable economic strategy. That's going to, you know, lead to more bickering, I expect.
But isn't that the, I mean, this is democracy, right? She makes her proposal and then they're going to make theirs. And in theory, they have to, you know, work out a deal or get more votes or sort of whatever the fix is to get it over the line. When I used to cover like municipal budgets, and we would at first kind of like treat these like, you know, the gods have like handed down tablets. But of course, that's not true. It's just, this is just the beginning of a process to make a plan.
Yeah, you know, and there's some truth to that. This is something that the mayor said many times. I think she said directly, you don't like what I put down, you know, you change it. And that's true. You know, the council is going to have a couple months to tinker with this. But it deserves to be said, you know, the mayor exerts a tremendous amount of influence in setting the budget, because at this point, all of the changes that she's made, the council, if they want to, say, find that $70 million for early childhood educators, that's a lot of money that they've got to then cut from somewhere else. And then that, you know, is sort of putting the onus and the perception back on them. You know, the public who doesn't follow this stuff, except for our loyal CityCast listeners, of course, you know, might not see that distinction in quite the same way. It would be like, oh, well, why is the council doing this? The mayor will certainly blame them if they cut, you know, some other program. They won't understand the distinction. So it's, you know, it's definitely the case that the council, in particular, Council Chair Phil Mendelson, will have a lot to change in this budget. I expect that they will manage to change some things. But look, I mean, like I said at the beginning, CFO Glenn Lee is insisting they devote $200 million to reserves that they really want to put elsewhere. And that is causing a lot of tension. Unless they resolve that, it will be difficult for the council to change anything.
This is going to be a subject that we're going to be talking about, hopefully with you, for a while. But before we switch gears today, speaking of our loyal CityCast listeners, what is this going to cost them? There's obviously another component, which is getting more money to run the city. And it's coming from someplace. Who's paying and what are we going to be paying?
Yeah. So I mentioned already an increase in the payroll tax, you know, which is going to affect businesses. That is essentially doubling back to the rate that it used to be a couple years ago. And then so long as the city's budget picture remains what it is, by next year, the mayor has said that she wants to start raising the sales tax, at first by 0.5% and then by another 0.5% after that, to go up to 7% to fund Metro. Metro, of course, has its own budget crisis. The city has to put up something like $200 million to help bail them out. They're counting on Maryland and Virginia and following suit. So they're sort of raising the sales tax and saying, hey, come on, guys, we need your help to do, you know, kind of the same thing here. And then there will also be a new tax. This one, less relevant for DC residents, it'll be on hotels, a small new fee on hotel stays. But that's something like 80 cents per night. It won't be super noticeable. There are also a few other changes to things like electric vehicles. Those have been exempt from taxes for a long time, but they're, you know, trying to bring those back a little bit. But, you know, by and large, the mayor tried to avoid tax increases in this budget. She is allergic to tax increases, and she says so all the time.
And I think her some of her council foes seem more into them. So we'll see what happens. Bottom line is there might be a little less money for people to be able to afford to go out to all of our DC James Beard award-winning restaurants.
Good transition, Mike.
Well, I mean, we started with broccoli, right? That's how we roll here. And now let's do the main course.
Everybody knows that getting that perfect Mother's Day gift is basically impossible, but we promise Mom will love this one. The Capitol Hill Restoration Society House and Garden Tour is back this Mother's Day weekend on May 11th and May 12th. Tour 9 elaborate homes and gardens and 3 historic buildings on Capitol Hill that you can't normally enter. And if you can't make it, check out the Capitol Hill Restoration Society's other events like walking tours and monthly preservation cafes. You can buy tickets for the Mother's Day House and Garden Tour on Eventbrite, and be sure to follow CHRS on Facebook and Instagram at Capitol Hill Restoration DC.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A bunch of restaurants in D.C. got James Beard Awards. The news came out yesterday. Jesse, you covered it. What do we know? Did anything surprise you? Did anything please you?
Yeah. So the James Beard Awards, for anyone who is not familiar, are very prestigious, high-profile awards for the restaurant industry across the country. And they came out with their finalist list. So the winners will find out in June. But D.C. had a really good showing on this last year. Was kind of hit or miss. DC won the biggest award. Rob Ruba, who runs this vegetable-centric tasting menu restaurant in Shaw called Oyster Oyster, was named Outstanding Chef, which is basically like, you're the best chef in the country, but no other DC awards last year.
And we interviewed him, by the way. So check out the link in our show notes.
Okay, yes. Great. And this year, we have a whole bunch of people in the finalist list. Some of the big names. Michael Raffiti from Albee, he is up for Outstanding Chef this year. Masako Marashita, who's the chef of Perry's, who's really been revitalizing this 40-year-old Japanese restaurant in Adams Morgan. She is contender for Emerging Chef. And another big one is Moon Rabbit, which is a modern Vietnamese restaurant. Their chef, Kevin Tien, is one of the finalists for Best Chef in the Mid-Atlantic. And their pastry chef is also up for the Best Pastry Chef Award. There are several others as well.
So I don't want to sound too much like a homer, but that's a pretty good collection of people compared to another city of the same size. Is DC's representation among the finalists for the Oscars of food above average, below average, about average?
You know, this is one of those things that ebbs and flows. I saw some media in Philly saying that Philly only had one finalist, which is pretty poor showing for Philly, which has a lot of great restaurants. It really comes in waves because DC got shut out of the awards in 2022. Last year, we had, you know, the one big award, and we'll see what happens.
Alex, have you eaten at any of these places?
I have. Perry's is great. And I similarly was glad to see them get some recognition. And I've been to the old Moon Rabbit, but not the new one. So I'm eagerly awaiting my chance to get downtown to see how things have changed and how they happen.
Jess, in your experience, is this going to make it harder for Alex to get reservations when he tries to do that?
It's already hard to get a Moon Rabbit reservation.
I've tried, so I can definitely verify that.
Wait, so Sidman, this week, my favorite story of yours was about a restaurant that doesn't exist anymore, Marivana.
Yes.
Which was a Russian restaurant, like just south of DuPont on Connecticut Avenue. And it wound up being discussed via a report in 60 Minutes that had nothing to do with the James Beard Awards or food in general. It's a wild story. Will you tell us?
Right. Well, to be fair, 60 Minutes broke this news and I reported it from their report. So I have to give them full credit. They've been doing this lengthy investigation with Insider and Der Spiegel into Havana syndrome. I don't know if you've heard about that, but there have been all of these national security officials who experience these attacks where they have this intense, crippling, drilling sensation in their ears, and it leaves them with these mysterious brain injuries. And it's been suspected that some kind of sonic high energy weapon has caused these symptoms.
And there's a fair number of people, just to be clear, a fair number of people who say it's all BS.
Yes, but there are many documented cases, first publicly known in Cuba in 2016, which is why they call it Havana syndrome. Anyway, so assuming that there is some sort of weapon behind these attacks, it hasn't been clear exactly whose weapon it might have been until now. This 60 Minutes report points a finger at Russia. And part of the reason is they interviewed an FBI agent who suffered such an attack, and she'd investigated various Russian spies. And she had been investigating one Russian spy in particular, who she'd interviewed 80 hours at the time of her attack. And his name was Vitaly Kovalev. And Washingtonians may or probably may not remember him as the opening chef of Marivana.
Wait, so how does a alleged intelligence operative wind up cooking in a DC kitchen?
That is such a good question. So the journalists who looked into his background discovered that actually he had studied radioelectronics at a military institute in Russia before he moved to the U.S. to become a chef. And actually, Marivana had helped sponsor his visa.
Well, the implication was that his chefing was like a cover for his dirty deeds, alleged.
That's kind of the implication, yeah.
But was he any good at chefing?
So he was only in D.C. for a very short period. He was there in 2013 when it opened. I actually interviewed him about his signature Russian dishes, like beef stroganoff. And then he left pretty quickly for New York. He helped open this restaurant that was run by a Russian-American pop star. And then, you know, his exact resume after that is a little bit fuzzy, but he seems to have stayed in New York. Then in 2020, he shows up again in Florida after a high-speed chase with police, going 110 miles per hour in a Mustang. When he's pulled over, the police find bank account notes, some sort of device that's used to erase a car's computer data, like a GPS, and a Russian passport. So this is the point in which he is being investigated. And he does plead guilty and he serves 30 months in jail. After that time, he returns to Russia against the advice of Americans who say you are in danger because you've spent so much time talking to the FBI. And then he allegedly died. A death certificate shows that he was killed fighting in Ukraine.
What was he like when you met him?
I'm going to be honest. I have zero recollection of this interview. It was in 2013.
That makes him a very good spy. You're not supposed to be memorable.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, Jess, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Alex, awesome to see you.
Always a pleasure.
And that is all for today here on CityCast DC. Our interim executive producers are Julia Caron and Kayla Cote-Stemmerman. Kayla also writes our super informative and fun newsletter, Hey DC. Our interim producer is Ash Durbin, and our hosts are Bridget Todd and me, Michael Schaefer from Politico. Music is by Alex Roldan. If you enjoyed the show, why not tell a friend, rate the show, leave us a review, and subscribe to our morning newsletter. We'll be back Monday morning with more news from around the city. Bye.